Thanks very much. And thank you very much, Ledbury Festival, for hosting the National Poetry Competition prize winners reading, as we do every year, which is one of the things we always look forward to. It is one of the prizes, indeed, of the National Poetry Competition. This is the leaflet for this year's competition. It's at the back. Do enter. It's one of the biggest competitions in the world, certainly the biggest in the UK. We have over 14,000, around about 14,000 entries. Huge number of poems to read, which we'll talk about a little later. We're going to hear from two of the winning poets and from one of the judges, hear their poems, and then we'll have a short discussion, talk about competitions and what they mean a little, and find out a bit more about the poets and their winning poems. So we're going to hear first from Fran Locke. Fran Locke was the third prize winner in this year's competition. She's had success in quite a few competitions, and she's also had several books out, actually, in quite short succession. The first of those was Flat Rock, and the amazingly titled The Mystic and the Pig Thief was last year's book. I think we've got copies at the back. And she's also appeared in many magazines and anthologies, including Best British Poetry 2012. We'll then hear from Roger Philip Dennis, who was the first prize winner in this year's competition. He's come from Devon today, one of the great journeys of our time, I believe, the Devon to Hereford run. Some of you may be familiar with it. We may venture into that, that territory later. Roger studied philosophy at St Andrews and did run a small magazine, actually, when he was at university. He then went and studied art and design in Dartington and became a visual artist, and he still works as a visual artist and painting tutor in Devon. We'll then hear from Roddy Lumsden. Roddy Lumsden was one of three judges on the competition with Zoe Scalding and Glyn Maxwell. And Roddy has, it's interesting with when people copy and paste biogs from previous collections and then try and add one, and sort of like, so if you have a biog where he's had five collections, six collections, seven collections, and you're trying to add them all on the end. We're on collection number 9 from Roddy. His new collection, Melt and Solve, comes out in September. And his previous collections include Yeah, 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 which was shortlisted for the Forward Prize, and The Book of Love, which was shortlisted for the T.S. Eliot Prize. And as well as being a poetry editor and tutor for the poetry school, he also has a career in quizzes. You might have heard him in Round Britain Quiz, where there's nothing that won't stump him. But he is also a poetry editor at SALT, the editor of their Best of British Poetry anthologies. And one of the things we might talk about later is a little bit about compiling anthologies. So thank you all for coming, and please join me in welcoming our first reader, Fran Locke.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming, and thank you for having me. One or more of us may live to regret that, so we're going to see how it goes. I now get here and I realise it's kind of the awful combination of terrible nerves and compulsively drinking water, so if I'm standing like this, that's why. I'm going to start with the competition-winning poem. Well, I didn't win, it came third, but... called Last Exit to Luton, and apologies to anyone from Luton, or indeed to people in general. He's a real man, you can tell. All plushy skunk and a dog you'd do well to avoid. Aaron's 23, says he could wear my moony face as a pendant, calls me Tweety Bird. I hang around his neck and Aaron drives. He's taking me out to get buzzed at a club. I'm wearing white denim spotless as a chorister, and we are sculling the druggy gale between the tire shop and the roundabout. We're leaving these scutty streets with their pawned gold and thawed meat far behind us. We're away up the town, gone for the gavelled abandon of smashed out me head for fighting squib with binge and living for the weekend. Aaron is not like the boys at home. Dimbulb chinless wonders who only want to trap you in the maundering bondage of marriage like their mothers. Aaron's got other ideas, got big ideas and vodka and jellies, and he understands. I'm mature, need more than pliant writhing in a narrow bed that howls like a chimney. He says, you're better than them, and he's right. I refuse to end up like that, like the girls at the camp, lank slags currying love and desperate quaking from spousal apathy. To be one of life's pale remainders, scrubbing my sink and trudging to church, burnt out on a soused downer again. I don't want to be tied to the site, to the tribe, to the old men, their tournaments and sorceries, to a fist and the face. I am special. I am rare, want gilt and spree and perfect hair and endless fucking diamonds. He will take me away. I know it. In the club we are spinning until my vision breaks into dizzy splinters. His kisses determine directionality. I'm lipping limoncello, lisping citronella, reeling round my handbag like a wasp around a bin. I see myself in the mirrored ceiling, well impressed with the brittle shimmy of me. Aaron is grinning, and I am watching the weaponized swag of my nails rinsed in warm red light and raving in front of my face, my own face big as a bill. Board, all is love, and there is God shining like a migraine. He will take me away, he says, but not today. Tonight it is back to his flat by flickering inches, and then to bed this mad, cabbagey firmament where I am rummaged and squirreled by turns. Aaron is smoking. The smoke hangs in the air like a spook house special effect. His back is baroque with spots, a constellated mire. He does not tell me that he loves me. He tells me I am old for my age, and I smile. I smile at his Jesus tattoo, pink and coy as a bearded lady. Jesus is smiling too. I have no plans. I don't want to go home. I have school in the morning. Hey, you know what they say about gypsy girls. Our life is either a circus or a zoo. I'm going to read maybe just one more because we don't have a huge amount of time. Because I was really nervous and people kept telling me that I had to get the audience on side by reading something that was germane to our human condition, something we all had in common. So I'm going to read a poem inspired by John Webster's notorious laugh riot, The Duchess of Malfi. It's called Dazzler. Like diamonds, we are cut by our own dust. No, not a duchess. His nature is a dance of iridescing, but a pallid aspie with a smoker's cough. I sit in the kitchen for hours at a time, compete with the fruit in the fruit bowl at withering, or lean into my mirror, unable to decide between ravaged or effaced. My lips are so red and so sharp they could kiss the skin off a cold peach, but whores pout. Ladies frown. I pixelate myself with pearl dust, coax my skin to a flat gleam. Nighttime is a paregoric lozenge. I am stately. I am waiting for all the tricks you'll try to send me mad. Where is my child? I held him as he slept, pink and twitching time-lapse like footage of a flower, a moment only. To fill the days, I learn the words to Lily Marlene and sing it out of the side of my mouth. I refuse to eat, and my Karen Millen maxi dress enfolds me like a fumigation tent. Where is my son, and where is his father? In the bathroom, my scallop nudity takes an age to upload. I am tired. I must move slowly, stand with my heels together, corrode and fold into souk blue shadow. My legs don't work, won't run. Prognosis, mermaid. Turn the radio on, heel and toe and howling, but no, I am nobody's loony, not yet. Open the window, let London's smoky starfield strain its light through my upturned face, breathe out my benzos and Bensons, I am nodding the sky inside of me. I will make my world in the air, my world, not this dingy Margaritaville of bland godliness. My world is dance not lived, head thrown back and vaulting a roar. My world is where my fingers married up and down his tattooed back. false nails walking a roseate rain, not a duchess, but a scheme of gowns and tapers. A lady is something planned like a heist. A lady is a conspiracy whispered up by brothers. I must parcel my hands demure at fist and flute. I have gone inside. I tell myself I am still myself, that I will kick more than I scream, and rather my scissors pretend to some indiscriminate vein than this. But I wasn't born for sweeping gestures. I shall buff my face to a solid shine and cut the hands I pass through. Thank you. I apparently have time for one more, so that was very nice, but it's slightly premature applause. For this poem, it requires a slight feat of imagination on your part. You have to imagine that I am a short, old Northern Irish man. You also have to imagine simultaneously that I'm a unicorn. I'll just give you a minute to get your head around that. This is a poem in which my grandfather is a unicorn. I'm not going to do the accent. My drill bit bonce is a power tool, pure Black and Decker. I don't joust but bore and cork. Laborious blue collar spirochete, I gauge, I weigh and countersink. Pallid navvy eye plot courses, grade curves and warble loony shanties under a flimsy freeloading moon. In summer, my kinked withers steam as I doss by the flat brown pond and champ at my backy. There, with any luck, some stringy, somnolent blonde will fodder me up bruised apples, smear deep heat on my sweated flanks. This is what passes for pleasure. Winter's worse, and when that chilly bastard climbs in at the window, me and my muckers huddle. In the cold, clammy dark, we are a row of raised middle fingers. We glow, spark and jar, rare as uranium rods we are, and twice as bloody depleted. Sometimes the ganger has a scourge staves in the frozen ground for, come, Mr. Tallyman, tally me a coffin, marking off the dead on the job. And sometimes he wants we should lance and spar and toro toro while the overseers spill tinnies and lay bets. 'Tis bad, but not that bad. You can always nuzzle with some ruddy board, have her hanky knot your billy beard. There's the cider squishy tang of her lank and gold as dirty straw. That, or you can dream, a dream of earth what didn't surge or churn, but green, sweetly, keenly me, yokeless and shiny, simpleton free. I dream when we was high horses, tilting into groves of gushing sun to munch at peerless pomegranates. That was long ago, though. Long ago and far away and maybe only make-believe. Pretty fiction's well and good, but we are none of us children. This is life, girl, and in the end I'm glue. You're glue, like the rest.
Good evening. Kind of start off with the prize-winning poem, which is Corkscrew Hill Photo. And this is a little portrait of someone I glimpsed years ago now. And I wrote the poem, or the poem arrived slowly many years after I first noticed this person in a cottage in Devon, when I was out taking photographs. And it was just a figure that I saw in the distance out of the corner of my eye coming out of a house. And gradually over time, she became somebody in my mind for some reason. This is the poem. Corkscrew Hill Photo. All afternoon, she counts the sounds, until the fly-specked room crackles with silence, even the song thrush noteless. A thick drizzle trickles rivulets down the window pane, smears distance on fields, curtains off hills, and greens the sagged thatch, aches in the creaking gate, and screws watering eye to misting glass. A hearse skids slowly up the muddy lane, blurs in droplets on a spider web, spins sideways into darkness. Rattling cough of cattle, rusty tractor, hinge of paint peeled door, gears of cars forced to back in one track lanes, buzz of pylons spanning the hum of outboards in the yachtsman's creek, yelp of kids in the converted mill, the soft click, click of a camera shutter up Corkscrew Hill. The casement steams with sunset. She picks herself up off the floor, mouth dry as mourner's grin. Her arm reaches, shakes, reaches again, gathers the clattering jar from the shelf. Cider? The landlord frowns, sniffing cat, mothball, mould. She squares her back on his fine view, the duck bob, seagull clutter, gape of lime kiln, and a nip of lovage, before he can point her, the off-license hatch in the yard, to keep out the damp, and smiles spittle. Her flagon scrapes a scroll of varnish the length of the bar's stripped pine, past bleating townies, past the regular's chair, and the corner where the photographer sits draining her valley through a tilted lens. That's that poem. And I thought I'd follow it with another portrait, this time of an old man. And this one is a historical person, and somebody from history and legend, Guillaume of Orange, who was born in 755 and was a cousin of King Charlemagne. And that's about 100 years before King Alfred, when Britain was a mass of small kingdoms. England itself was 7 kingdoms, I think. To put it in context. And he was a hero of the Chanson de Guillaume, one of the chansons of France, and I associate him with Roland, who was also another chanson, Roland died, in fact, fighting the Basques, though the songs have him fighting the Saracens, in 788, when Guillaume was 32, so they were associated. And Guillaume, in Occitan, in the language of Languedoc, he's known as Guillaume, and he founded Guillaume le Désert, the monastery of Gelon there. So, this is called, in French, Au bout du monde. That's all the French that's in their poem. Guillaume, restless at vespers, searches the autumn thunder for the rumble of hooves, the raw wind that cuts from the Pyrenees, for the dry, icy whistle of Saracen blade slicing skull, hearing in every kicked pebble the rattle of Roland's split horn. Dozing at matins, a fly's buzz recalls Orange, that long swoon of lavender, how he besieged its Roman walls, widowed and wed its Saracen queen, lemon groves, olives, fountains, libraries, its Greek, Coptic, Arabic, weaponries of peace whose wounds don't kill or heel. Knowns, back at court, how he tired of Charlemagne's redneck sons, left them to sink or swim, homing to hot Orange. But behind the cool, music-filled clusters of arched water gardens, the call of the desert lay waiting. So, joint stiffening, he took off to found a cloister at the world's end. But still had to fight. That old Saracen Don Juan, you see, decent fellow, sherbets, manners, peacocks, libraries, all that, but kept on rubbing out my monks. Had to go. Oh, well, old swords cut best, boy. Old swords in old hands. But clear off now. I'm on my knees till compline. It's hard work pitching the chant, hearing in every wheezed note the summons of Roland's lost horn. And that's that one. And I'll follow that with a different one, a little allegory or conceit called Summer in Devon. Might do for summer in Herefordshire, I suppose. But the only thing I'll say about this is the last word in it is ours, and that's hours as in minutes and days, not hours as in yours and mine. Makes a bit of difference. Sleep makes her nest in our ramshackle valleys, quietly burying time, her fading and redundant lover under a duvet of rolling hills, too green and heavy for dreams. You fight your way through a froth of flowers, through a nose-high choke of grass heads, all the long, hot, foot-clamping ennui of afternoon. She tells you, breathe deep, feeds you apple charlotte, scrumpy, homemade homity pie, tells you, her voice a buzz of bees, take life easy with rhubarb, gooseberry, elderflower fool. Windfalls roll, rot on the grass. Worms, slugs, wasps, gorge and binge. Below ground, her Lazarus stirs, slowly picking the padlock of shortening days. She runs her fingers through your hair. Your head, thick with fog, lies heavy in her soft lap, waiting, lethargic, postponing dread, seeing her face now rouged autumn red and wrinkled as fronds of browning bracken, her gaze, horizon fixed, dreaming how he'll step back up, spread out his frosty shroud, and tuck her in to his bed of hours. One more short one, I think, is there's time for. This different one, a bit more of a song. It's got a couple of references to Norse mythology, Ragnarok, which is the Armageddon, end of the world. And one of the main players that in that is Fenrir and the wolf. He is the wolf that eats up everything, one of the main characters. And to the Hydra, which is a many-headed beast, the more you cut the heads off, the more they grow. And to Hamelin, which I think should be familiar enough, of Pied Piper of Hamelin Town. So few characters in there. And I did originally call this the Millennium Rag, but due to fairly recent events, I decided to call it the Ship of State. The rats are all aboard. They've stormed the captain's deck, occupied the bridge, set course straight for Ragnarok. The wolf's jaws scrape the sky. His breath blasts ether holes. The sea sizzles with the acid rain of his hunger drool. So get sick, kid. This kick, no one scores. The small print on the freebie warned they'd phased out care, but you said, what the hell, laissez-faire pays my fare. When you woke spitting blood, you recognised the grip and just whose press-gang shilling had got you on this health trip. So get sick, kid. This kick, you don't score. You turned to Green Living to get the death hold canned, took part in Be Kind to Creatures Week, had meat banned, but in your dreams you heard the hydra hiss, and flowers with razor teeth rambled through your house. So get sick, kid. This kick, who knows who scores? Then you let the rats in. You thought you could keep them down, but then you lost overboard the chart that led to Hamelin Town. Got them to rig your ripoff for you, but then you got their check. Left you scuttled, clinging to the rigging, wolf breath blistering your neck. So get sick, kid. That way, you just might score. I'll leave you enough. Thank you.
Hi there. I'm going to read four poems, all of which are about and for female friends. The first two are kind of both, in different ways, slightly listy poems. This first poem is called Photograph of Emily Hasler Napping. And Emily Hasler is a young English poet and has been one of my students. And this was a Facebook photo that her boyfriend put up of her kind of looking inelegant on the sofa under a duvet. While he was watching one of the minor games of the World Cup. They're both into football, but I think this was sort of, you know, the Maldives versus Kuwait or something, you know, and she wasn't that into it. And I really liked the photo, and I wrote this poem because I'm fond of Emily. And it started out as a comic poem, and then it kind of turned. Photograph of Emily Hasler napping. Not on a rope swing, not in cocktail chic, never in a jeep, and not macheteing yams, not randoming, at least not evidently, not at present passing any parcel, not leading that pirate mutiny, neither Minotaur nor Sphinxish, not nearing Waverley Station singing out Mama, and never swimming the Rhine in Basel, after a polymer seminar. Always seeming, though, schooled in arrival. Shoeless, one assumes, and aiming inwardly to best of destination. Swimming hope's foss. Flies scam the window. The commentator irks. A half-read book, minor to this whole scene, has taken half a year to topple. Now it does. And this is a very recent poem. It's called So Glad I'm Me. And this was a friend of mine in my local called Claire. And she'd had one too many and was sitting opposite me. And she's got long hair and it was kind of drooping over her face as she was slightly nodding off. And she just reminded me of Sandy Denny. And I thought, I'm going to write a poem about tragic heroines. So this is a list poem. It's deliberately packed with allusions, some of which you'll get, some of which you won't. There are two really quite obscure ones, which I'll tell you. One of which is Ponette, Ponette is the bleakest film I've ever seen. It's a French film from the 90s, which is a desperately bleak film where most of the actors are five or under. And Esther Greenwood is the Sylvia Plath character in The Bell Jar. Claire was nodding off, and there was a hen party, really drunk outside, and at one point she just suddenly woke up and just said, "So glad I'm me." Claire Waning, Warhol cameo girl, Sandy Denny post-recording, tired girl with a coffee in a Fellini, sleepy writer after novel's end, Esther Greenwood roping in her thoughts, little sister on a bad night out, Antigone winding down, unsure system, zoo creature you have to lean and read the explanation of, daughter in a kitchen sink drama, stabled pony turning at the sight of snow, so glad I'm me, gold panned in faraway stream, smoke, the lady of the fountain in the Mabinogion, oh sleep if sleep exists, Ponette, grown up, Tinkerbell, now glued to the idea of heading home to the duvet, gypsy girl from the flake advert, frustrated aviatrix, Lorna Doone escaping, all the lucky tousle is upon you, nodding, being downed by Lady Petrel, tired girl, Jane Eyre with an eye patch, Leonard Cohen's Nancy looking at the Late Late Show, on the wind down, Shakespeare, step in. Lady Petrel, by the way, is white wine. That's what my friend calls it. So two more. This is about a much younger female friend. It's called On First Meeting Margot. Margot is my friend's daughter, who is five this weekend, actually, but she was three when I wrote this poem. And I had never met her before, and I bumped into her with her mum on the street. And I'm very, very fond of small children, very charmed by them. And when Margot was born, Wayne, my friend, and his partner had a kind of running joke that actually Margot was mine. The reason being that Margot, even from when she was a small baby, has a habit of doing this, sitting like this. And one of my author photos has me doing this. And so it was nice to meet her. And at the time that this poem was written, it was only a few months after I'd suffered quite a nasty head injury. And that comes into the poem, On First Meeting Margot. Oh, sorry, Egham and Swindon are the places their her parents are from. When you were born, they said you looked like me, as if only. But now I see your daddy's eyes right away and think how fond I am of him. As you twist around your mother, pranking, having a busy day. And your mother is still bringing off the perfection, as she ever has. Margot, I'm concussed. One day you'll know what that means. Each minute or so I tell myself beneath my breath, be careful. Today I counted the people I truly love and didn't use too many fingers. I can't play the classical guitar, have never slalomed, and rum does very little for me. I'm still in love with someone who is growing uncomfortable with that. I have limited patience for theatre of the real or metaphorical sorts. Excuse me, Margot, I am introducing myself somewhat awkward, but you seem anyhow to prefer spinning round mummy more than my persuasive interference. Your shy smile is the best of it. You will talk any dog off a ledge. You will shuck both Egham and Swindon, being the new breed. Luck dances as you dance. All will be best. I will mend as you grow, important one. I shake your hand in stately fashion. Lady, that was a blessing to meet you, to be that. It was a day of remark. So twice in my life I've very nearly met Carrie Fisher, the Star Wars actress. And both times, the first time she didn't turn up. She was a kind of friend of a friend of my brother's. And the second time I decided not to go and see her because a mutual friend had introduced us, but I decided, thought it would be a bit awkward. For 3 years I shared a flat with a Finnish dancer and choreographer in her 20s, and she became like my sort of pseudo-daughter, and I became her pseudo-father, and we were both comfortable with that. And we lived in what we called the Prendergast Zoo, because Prendergast was the name of the road. So, Ihana Tansia, which is the first two words of this poem, is Finnish for lovely dancer. And Moi Moi in Finnish is a bit like ciao in Italian. It can mean hi or bye. So this is about Heidi. And myokymia, the poem's called Myokymia, / Carrie Fisher. Myokymia is something I suffer from sometimes, which is basically what's sometimes called a lazy eye or a twitchy eye. It's caused by a weak muscle here, which means that if you get a little bit tired or stressed, the eye begins to twitch and flutter. Right. So this is written after she moved out to go and live abroad. Johanna Tansia, when you left, I felt the tundra. Laughter in a nearby room, noir rememberings. Plates lacked sheen. Your sequence on the carpet catch still on my twitchy eye. How many times I asked if people thought I am winking at them. A man followed me home in Edinburgh, thinking I was wanting him. A few wide eyes. Daddy, daughter. Yes, that's what we were. But sometimes me, the daughter, I'd have to say, as you shepherdessed me, not knowing my route to cross the stepping stones. Twice in my life I have nearly met Carrie Fisher. I moved to the sofa because she was staying at my brother's place before you were born. She never did arrive. I have never seen Star Wars. Bella loves Star Wars. A decade back, a mutual friend said Carrie and I were surely like-minded and that we should meet. I spilled on that, the famous being not my notion. First night you moved in, you took your hair down, your stagey makeup off, appeared in the hallway of our Prendergast Zoo in those kitten pajamas. I feared I'd fall for you, but it was a different love we brewed, careful business, sorting one another. Sure, sure I miss you, and the soup I made you, and your supple way, and the giant wedding dress we stored beneath my bed. I know a little Finnish. A little, moi moi. And when you left, you said, good luck with your class. But I heard instead, good luck with your plans. Ouch, I have no plans. And I said back, farewell, Tansia, as I climbed down four flights to the real world. Luck unlocks us and steals our stuff. I have long done with luck. Do you think I should try a third time with Carrie? I think she would shrug. I fear we might small talk. Heidi, we became strange muscles in one another. You slurped tea, went for pirates, risked, risked, and rose. But I know the rose placed on my grave will likely be from you. Moi moi. Wink, wink.
Both very much, and we've just time for a very sort of short discussion, but I thought I was going to begin with Roddy, but I'll give you a moment to get your breath back after the reading. So I thought, could I just begin asking a little bit about those poems you both read first and where they came from? So Last Exit to Luton. I was asking if you had any connection to Luton and
it's not your home place.
It's not. I don't really have a home place. I've stayed in lots of different places. But we did live kind of on the outskirts of Luton for a bit. And it was always like this sort of terrifying and forbidding centre that I didn't want to go into. And I came to write the poem, which is sort of an amalgam of experiences about growing up sort of in and on the fringes of traveller communities. And I wanted to set it somewhere suitably grotty. And I tried to think about the grottiest place I knew, and that was Luton. So that's the poem became Last Exit to Luton. It's kind of taking off Hubert Selby Jr.'s Last Exit to Brooklyn, in which all sorts of, you know, outrageous, explicit things happen. I wanted to find the place less Brooklyn-like in the world, and I can't think of anywhere less Brooklyn-like than Luton. So that's the whyness of that.
And in terms of when you're sort of deciding whether to enter a poem to a competition or whatever, when you were writing that, what made you submit that to a competition rather than a magazine or sit on it or whatever?
My friend Catherine, who had been prodding me and poking me, going, when are you going to enter the National? When are you going to enter the National? When are you going? You have to enter the National. She just kept poking me and poking me. And I didn't know it was going to be that poem. And in fact, I didn't really want it to be that poem or intend it to be that poem. But in the end, I kind of just went, oh, for God's sakes, and kind of sent it off because I was getting fed up of being nagged. I didn't have any anticipation that it would be even in the running. In fact, I thought it was kind of quite the opposite, that it was this kind of horrifying, depressing, slightly sort of explicit and shocking thing that would revolt and repulse people at 100 miles an hour. So it was kind of a fit of pique sort of entry, really.
Thank you. And Roger, so you when you introduced the poem, you gave a slight, you told us a little about it. Tell us a little bit. So it's called Corkscrew Hill Photo. And was Corkscrew Hill the place where that happened, or did you amalgamate two memories?
No, that is where it happened. It's a place down in Devon. And it was quite a long time ago, the original event, back in the early 80s, after I'd been doing the art course down in Devon and art and design in Dartington. And I was out taking photographs for a little project. In fact, there's been quite a nice circle there because it was a little tape slide project. So it was a slide performance of photographs presented on a program recorded on a tape, sound tape, so the slides were synced to a audio, music and words. So there was a film poem made at the final of the poems in the competition. Has been a nice sort of circle of completion in a way. So that's what it came from.
So the original incident that triggered the poem was back in the 80s. Did you start writing the poem immediately?
No, I didn't. It was several years later that I started the first draft, and that went in a drawer pretty quickly for rather a long time, and then came out again a few minutes later, and then back again. So it's taken a long time in the writing, in terms of being put away and then sort of got out, looked at, cut mainly,
and
pruned and then.
Because I mean, it was a very unusual story, in fact, for the National Poetry Competition in a way, because you'd written your poem quite recently, immediately, yeah. Sort of before the deadline, but yours had been brewing for 30 years.
Yes, growing slowly.
Which just goes to show, go and look in your drawers, I think, is the moral of that tale, and see what's in there. So, Roddy, you were judging the competition, and you've judged quite a lot of competitions. What's it like, and I should say, what the way to make it slightly more manageable for the judges, all the judges read the poems, but they see two-thirds each, so two judges see all the poems. So you had 10,000
9,500.
What is it like to read 9,500 poems, and what do you see? What do you see coming up and coming up and coming up?
Well, I had 2 months to do it, so but even then, I still had to make sure I did 300 a day or something, What comes up more than anything? Mums. Yeah. Stylistically, what happens is you start to get rather tired of even quite good poems, but because you've seen, you know, a lot of quite similar poems, and quite often I think what happens in competition is when you're reading say anything over 1,000, is it's the something that really strikes you as being different, and that was partly what Roger's poem was. Mm. It just struck me as being. What I really liked about it was that it seemed slightly off kilter, but it was also rather charming, and it was, I couldn't work out, you know, it has a kind of, don't take this the wrong way, I've already said this to you, it has a slight naivety to it, which is to do with the woman herself, I think, but it also has really good detail and really striking diction. And when I remember exactly where I was when I wrote it.
Read it. Just to make that point clear.
Yeah, actually, I wrote it and sent it to Roger. No, I didn't. When I read it,
much.
And I just remember, I mean, when you're reading 9,000 poems, or you know, a batch of say 400 or 500, you don't read poems twice. And if you read a poem twice, you know it's going to go into your shortlist. And I read it 3 or 4 times. I just thought, yeah.
So I remember when you delivered your shortlist, it was on the top, and yeah. You were.
Yeah, and it was a poem. I mean, the other judges liked it too, but it was very much the one I was making a case for, just because it had just had an effect on me, mm-hmm. and on rereading, it held up. Hearing it again today, still, you know, it's lovely to hear some of those lines I really like.
And what was it about Franz, do you think, that leapt out for the judges? What was?
Franz wasn't actually in my batch, but I know Franz's work very well, and because I recognised her style, I actually had to sit out once I recognised it was Franz on the judging day, which is one of the rules. What is it about Franz's work? It's just very arresting and very fresh. I mean, Fran won, the second poem Fran ran tonight won the AMPIC competition, which I judged, and I didn't recognise it was Fran's poem, because it's about a woman with a child who smokes Benson's and wears caramel and dresses, and those are not very Fran things. But this is one thing I wanted to mention briefly, actually, is this thing that happens when someone you know wins. You know, Fran won the AMPIC competition, less than a year after I edited and published her last collection, and she's a long-term student of mine and a friend. So, but the thing is, I didn't know in that case. It happened before. My friend Patrick Brandon won a competition I judged, and it's because I gave out leaflets to my students, and my students are good. Mm. And I really didn't recognise the poem. I'd never seen it before. Mm. But when I found out it was one of my friends who'd won, it's like, oh no, people are going to whisper, but often, sometimes these things can happen completely innocently.
Mm. And so, I mean, what's the difference for you between reading a poem that is anonymous compared to when you're, say, selecting something for an anthology, when you're reading magazines and you're choosing what to go in and you know who it's by and you have all of that hinterland of story of where people are and their careers and everything?
Yeah, I think you make assumptions. I mean, on the first two readings of Roger's poem, I thought it was set in Australia. Mm. For some reason, I really thought, maybe it's because Corkscrew Hills, to me, somehow sounded Australian. I mean, there's nothing in it to suggest Australia. That's where I saw it. Mm. Yeah.
And Roger, you alluded to the fact, so with the National Poetry Competition, one of the things we've done for the last couple of years is we've made short films of all of the winning poems and the commendeds as well, just to also get a wider audience. And what was it like to pass your work over, both of you, to a different artist to interpret how they liked, you know, without being able to control it and say, no, I don't see her like that, I don't see that space like that? How did the film work for you?
It was slightly terrifying to kind of let go, but once
Once I had, it was fine. The only thing I had with it was because I posted the film to the blog when it came out, and everyone was like, oh, you know, that's a really, really interesting sort of image of you. That's not me, that's the person in the video. But that's the only kind of issue I had with it, and I think that, as Roddy was saying about, you make assumptions, and I think that's really interesting. And I hadn't actually met the person that did the film poem, so I'm kind of interested that that's clearly how they saw me.
That's how they saw the person, the voice of the poem.
Yeah, so there's that. It was interesting in that way, but I didn't have a problem with it. I think it's actually quite healthy to kind of push your poems out there and give them to someone else, either to be edited or to give them to an artist to collaborate with, because it makes it less obsessively personal, which is, you know, can only be a good thing, really.
And Roger, how about you? Sort of, what do you think? Did the film add anything you haven't seen, or take away the core moment? Or
yes, I mean, I was first, you know, wondering when I first talked about it or started to be a reality, that whether I should be trying to influence or wanting, whether I wanted to actually, or would have preferred to have been involved in the process. But I fairly soon decided that no, it was going to be really interesting to see what somebody, another artist, did with the poem, you know, with nothing, just working from the page. And I think it was very, I mean, I really like what James did with it, James Norton, and it's particularly that it, I'd been seeing that back in the past, because the event was back in the past anyway, and I knew what I'd seen was an old lady back in the past. That's not emphasised particularly. What he saw was a much younger person and much more up to date. So that pushing it forward in time and bringing it up to date, as it were, I think is really very exciting, and I really like it, even if it adds something that I hadn't thought of.
So I know that there's another event that follows, so we'll call this to an end, but thank you very much for coming, and maybe that last line of your poem as well, the kind of luck, is very much involved as well. So thank you, all three of you. Thank you very much.